listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. So tonight's program is called How Memories Get Made. And author Terry McDermott writes, "Imagine the brain as a huge storehouse, with shelf after shelf, miles long, filled with a wild assortment of tableware, teacups, saucers, platters, ceramic bowls, crude pottery, fine china, simple dinner plates. The tableware may once have been stored tidily, but an earthquake has leveled the interior. The resulting huge pile of wrecked shelves and broken plates is the geography that a neuroscientist must navigate while trying to discern patterns and coherence in the brain. We're here tonight to celebrate and absorb some of what happens when a great writer takes on a great subject and succeeds. Terry McDermott's fascinating 101 Theory Drive, A Neuroscientist's Quest for Memory, is that outcome. McDermott, an award-winning journalist, spent nearly 2 years observing neuroscientist Gary Lynch at work. Gary just said he considered Terry an embedded reporter. His account of the highs and lows of life in the lab, his lucid explanations of Lynch's quest to find the definitive key to memory's code are thrilling. And if you aren't already excited about science, and I assume most of you are here tonight because you are, I swear this book is your best chance. McDermott describes Gary Lynch. He was the damnedest sort of intellectual sophisticate, able at a moment's notice to muster powerful, nuanced arguments on the most abstruse philosophical points, to discuss with forbidding intellectual force a frightening range of subjects, yet utterly at a loss to bluff his way past the least revelation of what he might be fibbing about. That was a pretty great description. And here's Gary Lynch, quoted by Terry McDermott, and I love this. "Belief is a tricky business, and you have to be excessively careful. You have to have ideas and to pursue them with vigor, but you also have to regard all your assumptions as rebuttable. Everything you know is always at risk. If you are truly doing science, you can get your hat handed to you at any moment." That's a pretty great description. So tonight, as I said, we are extremely fortunate to have both the writer and the subject here with us at the library. And to make the evening even more special, we have Larry Swanson, Appleman Professor of Neuroscience at USC, as interlocutor. Very simple introductions. Terry McDermott is a former national reporter for the Los Angeles Times and the author of Perfect Soldiers, The 9/11 Hijackers, Who They Were, Why They Did It. He specializes in long-term projects, often immersing himself in an assignment for months or occasionally years. And he's written on an enormous range of subjects. And you might want to check out Terry's website because he has many of his long projects, his articles online there. Gary Lynch is one of the most cited neuroscientists in the world and the author of more than 550 scientific articles. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Irvine, and the co-author of Big Brain, The Origins and Future of Human Intelligence. And Dr. Larry Swanson is Appleman Professor of Biological Sciences and a member of the Neuroscience Research Institute at USC, where he directs a laboratory investigating brain systems that control motivation and emotion. His recent book, Brain Architecture, Understanding the Basic Plan, presents a new theory of nervous system organization, and his atlas, Brain Maps, is in his third edition. And I hope I didn't forget anything. Please welcome Gary Lynch, Terry McDermott, and Larry Swanson to the library.
I'm in the middle. I'm always in the way.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Louise for putting us together. You can tell, I think, already it's going to be an interesting evening. And just by way of a little introduction, I've known Gary Lynch since the 1970s, when we were both pretty young scientists, and he was the thorn in the side of my advisor. I was in St. Louis, and Gary was out in California, the young upstart who was actually doing a lot of really innovative stuff. And so we've known each other a long time, And 3 or 4 years ago, my neighbor in the South Bay, who I hadn't really gotten together with for several years, mentioned, I found out he was writing a book on neuroscience, and it was about Gary Lynch. So this whole series of interesting interactions took place. So I'm just basically saying we've actually known each other quite a while, so we can start to sort of get into some very interesting stuff here. And as Louise pointed out, you know, Terry has written some amazing stuff, a book about the 9/11 terrorists. He's written about the origins of hip-hop, you know, coming out of a swap meet in the South Bay. He's written, actually, one of his best articles was in December of 2006 on Barack Obama before he declared his run for the presidency, which basically predicted he'd win. And so, you know, he's done all of this really interesting stuff. And so the first question has got to be, going from this, how did you ever get, where did this idea of doing something about memory and neuroscience come from?
Where all stories for newspaper people come from. Fear of an editor and, and desperation. I just finished the work on the 9/11 book, and it had been a really long, hard slog. It lasted several years, and it was deeply depressing, just the subject itself, dealing with it that long. And when I went back to work, back to the Los Angeles Times, they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I really don't have an idea yet, but I know I want it to be fun and I want it to be easy. So I brain science. I'd had an idea on my list of stories for 10 or 15 years that I hadn't done called Where's My Car? having to do with my inability to find my car when I left work at night.
A simple start.
Yeah, so that's what I thought. Then I thought, I could do that. I could find a lab where they'd let me hang out, and if there's a project that they were working on, I could follow to build the spine of a story off of. So it wouldn't be a term paper. It'd be a narrative story. And I called around, made a list of names. I knew nothing about neuroscience. I had even less biology training than Gary had. and started calling around, talking to people, and which figure out where I could go. And eventually I ended up driving down to Irvine just after Christmas 2004 and met with Gary. And, you know, 2 minutes into the conversation, I made it my pitch, told him what I was wanting to do. And he said, this would actually be a propitious time to come to the lab. And I thought, that's an unusual word for a scientist to be using, propitious. And not knowing what unusual words were to come, I said, well, why is that? And he said, we're about to nail this motherfucker to the door.
The reporter's ears go straight
so
up.
So I said, what time do we start? That's how I ended up there.
But, you know, Gary, here you are, a scientist. You know,
reportedly.
What scientist in their right mind is going to let a reporter from the L.A. Times come into their lab like carte blanche? I mean, this is a...
Yeah, well, it's a funny kind of thing. I mean, I'm a scientist first and an academic second, very much so. So it's actually very useful to have someone from the outside looking at your enterprise. I mean, even if that someone is, even if that someone's Terry. he's not exactly overwhelming in appearance and coming on with knowing about the background. I mean, it was a little discouraging when I laid eyes on it. Let's put it that way. You know,
I could write another book, you know. And what are you going to do? Do another experiment?
I could name a protein. The Terry. Now, the Terry would be that protein that causes all of your experiments to go south. See, the thing of it is the Terry comes into the lab. No, but to answer your question, what you're looking for... It's first place, everybody in the world has a story to tell, and right. Scientists have stories to tell that are all very deep, very long, and we think fascinating, and the world should know about them. Also, frankly, it was the idea that maybe it would be a good thing for people to have some idea of what it is actually going on in those labs.
All right.
And I looked at his stuff, and, you know, he obviously digs deep.
Yeah. So what was your strategy? I mean, here you are, no training in biology. trying to understand actually a very complicated science, you know, the science of the brain and memory. What was your basic strategy when you went down there to get a story?
Write stuff down. I mean, that's all you do. I report, and I don't worry about the story in that period.
So this wasn't over the phone or anything. I mean,
I went there every day for most. I basically joined the lab for most of a year, and of course, it was only supposed to be a few weeks or a couple months, and then 6 months, and then at the end of the first year, Gary said, "We'll get it next year," and at the end of that year. If you go, and the people in the lab, especially Gary, were tremendously generous in their time. They showed me how they did stuff, and I watched, and I read, and talked, and just accumulated stuff. And I figure eventually a story will emerge out of that.
So, like, you know, Gary, what's the scenario down there? How big is your, how many people are in this lab? What's it like? I mean,
it's a lot like in that book. He did capture not only what the project's about, but how the stuff actually works. You know, there's going to be, at any given time, 15 or 20 people. They're all going to be working. There's a great piece in the book where it struck Terry about how silent it is in there, because they're all working. You know, if you go in and you see happy people, it had better be one of two things, right? You got a grant or you got a great result. You're happy. Why would you be happy? I mean, this is not happy stuff. This is miserable stuff.
But, you know,
see, the thing of it is, the dirty secret about science is, this could be spelled out in a minute, the stuff doesn't work, okay? I mean, everything you know about it, you know this. Larry?
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff doesn't work. 95% of the time, you run these experiments and they don't work. And if your emotion upon that failure isn't misery, then it's kind of my job to help you feel miserable.
He's pretty good at that.
Yeah. So it's people working in a very steady, dedicated, hard way. It's painful, and the only reason they're doing it is because they think that at the end of this, there's going to be something really wonderful that's going to happen.
You know, and there are two parts of this book that I love. One actually is the story of Gary's research, but the other is this culture, subculture, of what it's like to be a scientist, a young scientist, a student, the whole mixture. But, you know, to get this, Gary, this is an incredibly interesting story. Here's a scientist that's been working on the same problem for about 30, 40 years. You know, how does memory work? So this takes an amazing amount of endurance and perseverance. And did you realize this, you know, sort of side of the story when you started, how science works, sort of?
Well, yeah, no, I didn't realize the amount of failure. I mean, I knew that there was a lot of it, but I didn't realize that it was daily. And neither did they until I got there. It was the strangest thing. I mean, stuff that they had done every day for a year that did work quit working. Computers crashed. Some of them actually started, whiffs of smoke would come up from them. They showed me how to do some of the basic experimental techniques, and of course I broke the apparatus. And this goes on for weeks, and nothing's working. And what I've had figured out by then was that scientists, at least neuroscientists in this kind of lab, are really superstitious people. They do, and you think about it like athletes, they do the same thing every day, and yet they get wildly discrepant results. So they're always trying to eliminate every variable they can and absolutely repeat faithfully the same thing so that they get the same results. So it's predictable and replicable. And then, 3 or 4 weeks in, nothing's working at all, and they look around and see what's different in the lab. You know, it's like, hi. You know? So this is when Gary started calling me the black hand of fate.
Isn't it time for Terry to go over to the other part of lab now? And I'll bet Terry would be really interested.
But, you know, you get into this almost obsession with figuring out a problem, you know. And Terry starts by saying, well, how do I remember where my car is? And I forget 50% of the time where it is. But, you know, everybody here knows that the really serious stuff that goes wrong with memory, Alzheimer's and so on and so forth, this is really serious stuff. And so it'd be interesting to know, you know, from Gary, What is it that has kept you going on the same basic thing for 30 or 40 years?
Jameson's.
Yeah, Mr. Jimmy is a big help. To me, there's always been two kinds of profound mysteries. Science without mystery is just something I am not interested in. I see science as being the modern day mystery machine. Again, this notion that science answers things. Well, yeah, we do that. But science at the same time creates profound, deep mysteries. And those mysteries grab and enthrall and fascinate us. And to me, on the one side of the world, you can see the deep mystery of fundamental cosmology, physics, right? And that stuff is just, you know, every year that we get into it, there's a deeper and deeper and deeper mystery, deeper and deeper problem. And if you go elsewhere and you try to find something equivalent to that, the only thing that I could think of was in here. There is a thing called thought, and there is a thing called consciousness. And when you say, what is thought? What are we? What is it in that inner world as opposed to that outer world? That's the question for me. What is it? So the thing that I perceive, still think, was blocking memory and blocking progress toward understanding to building a neurobiological description of thought was that we had no idea how memory works. No idea at all. So when I started, it was just it was a babble. And so that's all changed over the years. And now we have, the idea was when you get that out of the way, then you would be able to move on and answer questions about where is memory. And once you have an idea about where memory is, you can begin to ask the question of how is memory assembled into a thought. And when you have that, you're standing on the threshold of a biological description of what a human being is. I thought that was something worth doing.
That's not bad now. Harry goes down there.
Yeah, unlike my meaningful work.
But, you know, there's also this group of people, mostly young people in the lab. Gary's got some way of sort of inspiring this work ethic and this, how do you, you know, the dynamics of the lab, how did you get in, what did you actually see, how did it work?
That's the misery whip, you know. Well, you know, all the people who end up in these labs are bright people, and they wouldn't have put in the time they did to get there if they didn't really care about it. Mm-hmm. And numerous people who've been in the lab over decades, different times, would say the same thing, that Gary's ability to inspire is unparalleled, that he could make you think that what you were doing was the most important thing that had ever been done in neuroscience. And they would just go through walls, sometimes thrown. There was a guy in the lab for quite a while, Kevin Lee, who got involved in an experiment looking for the structural change in neurons that Gary had hypothesized as the cause of memory or the underlying reason that it lasts. And this experiment went on for 2 or 3 years. Yeah. I mean, they were just killing rats by the thousands, and they're getting nowhere. And Lee told me, he says, you know, it was miserable. I mean, it really was. Everybody was just, it was just a horrible place to be. And you know, and Lynch would just be in there, you know, you got anything? And Lee says, you know, I thought, Gary, in fact, one time he says, it was like Guadalcanal. It was horrible. And Lee says, I decided, God damn it, if he ain't going to stop, I ain't going to stop. So it's the stubbornness. Why anybody who does something that seems hopeless does it. I mean, we're human.
You know, we know a lot. There are TV shows about med students and law students and all of this. But as far as I know, there's almost nothing about just sort of the culture of science and the young people that are in it and why they're in it. And, you know, is it really any different than any other professional training? Is there something special that you, maybe you noticed, Terry, since you've got a really...
Well, it's boring.
You got to really be able to put up a point.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons there aren't books written about life in laboratories is that, seriously, day to day, most people are standing there staring at a screen, looking for a wave change in something for hours. And they do this day after day after day. So if you're there long enough, you can compress events so that, you know, everybody doesn't go to sleep when they read it. So there's that. I mean, you really have to have this this, again, extraordinary patience, because you know their failure is going to happen over and over. You just have to keep at it. I mean, Gary said one time, he says, you know, science, neuroscience in particular, but science generally is a highly refined human activity, but it's a human activity. So they're just people.
And this is one of the great things about this book. I think it really humanizes the whole process.
Yeah, I think he caught that. They are scientists, and they are also characters.
Yeah.
And one of the more entertaining things about having a laboratory over the years is that it's remarkable. They are very, very bright people, but they oftentimes, to be successful at this, have got to have something wrong with them. I mean, you can see two examples right here. I mean, anybody that, and that, by the way, is not to say that the newspaper people or writers don't have their little gears that aren't in sync, but they've got to have something wrong with them to do this. It's not like a completely sane human being would say, sure, fine, for the next 20 years of my life, I'm going to sit and cut up brains.
Right.
But that makes some characters. That makes some characters. And some of these people are really, really fascinating people to have around, and some of them are real entertaining people to have around. This character, Kevin Lee, he mentioned, who, by the way, went on to become the head of neuroscience at the University of Virginia and had a tremendous career. It's just this absolutely fascinating character, just this great, I will never forget, he came down from USC, and I had a baseball team at that time, right? In fact, I would recruit people for the baseball team.
So he was an undergrad over there at USC?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. And I would recruit people to the lab because of their baseball skills. So this kid started showing up down there, and he was playing shortstop, and I will never forget the day that Kevin was going to get signed into the lab, and it was a guy hit a high fly pop back over second, over third, and Kevin went running after it. And as he was running after it, he was narrating the play. It was one of these things like, look at that kid go. He's dead. He's going. He dives. He's got it. What a play. Boy, that kid Lee. And, you know, and a couple joints, and then, you know, and I said, man, I got to have that guy from my
life. You come can here. Sort of see where this is going.
Yeah, come here, kid. What are your career objectives anyway?
Like broadcasting.
And so I'm saying, I tell that story. Kevin was an enormous character, and we have a lot of those. And I think that's one of the things.
There's a woman in the lab now, Lulu Wai Chen, who was a chemistry major as an undergrad. And took a couple years off and came back and went into neuroscience. And I asked her why. She says, you know, chemistry labs are terrible places to be. She says, you're figuring out polish won't last 5 minutes. You can't wear a skirt. It's just ridiculous. You know, I thought, I'll go to neuroscience. And she goes into Chris Gall's lab as a grad student, maybe just a normal rotation or something. I don't even know how it was. And she said, the first day, Chris says to Lulu, she says, are you okay with animal work? And Lulu thinks, I don't pet him, you know. and she's scared to death. You know, she's never been in a neuroscience lab before. She says, sure. So she walks in. Within 5 minutes, Chris Rex cutting the head off a rat, taking the brain out, you know, slicing up the hippocampus. You know, and the rat's body is twitching in the waste paper basket, and Lulu's sitting there like this. But, you know, she turns out to be a great scientist.
Yeah, she's brilliant. She's one of those cases that's a pure...
She told me, she said she knew so little that she figured that everything she did wouldn't work. So she knew that going in. And when she thought if it would take 20 times to do something, when she got to 10, she'd go, great, I failed halfway to success.
Well, you know, this is this leads in the opening of the thing tonight with Terry, I'm going to nail this thing. Come in here. We'll have the answer in a month. We're going to solve memory. We'll get in a minute to what that solution might be. But after 2, 3, 4 years, Terry, you're writing the book. You're coming up to the last chapter there. Now, how do you end this? I mean, was the whole thing solved, or is that how it worked?
Well, just like them. That wouldn't happen until the book was done. No, it wasn't at the end of the book. And, you know, the thing, I actually went back through every conversation with Gary I'd ever had at one point in the writing of this. and cataloged all the different times when he predicted the end. And it was always, I mean, sometimes it was like tomorrow or, you know, next week or 6 months or next year. But whatever it is, we're going to be there. And we're going to be standing on the mountaintop and we're just going to look down in the valley and we're all going to be happy. And so, I mean, and I don't think he lied every one of those times. that wasn't that much fun to have around.
No, that's an understatement.
So, no, it wasn't done. But to me, that was actually a better ending in a lot of ways, since it was the only one I had available to me. But it was just, I mean, that's the nature of science. It doesn't end. It just goes on. But they've made remarkable progress since I left.
Which
now that the equipment's all working again.
Yeah, now which speaks volumes.
Yeah. But you begin to see the picture here, this enthusiasm, this never-ending enthusiasm for solving this mystery, which is really important. And, you know, yeah, you started back in the 70s. So how would, you know, people are interested in memory. How would you actually explain the biology, you know, of remembering what happened tonight at this... we're out signing books, and you're thinking back about what happened during the lecture. I mean,
well,
how does that happen in the brain?
The one part of it, which two things were happening when Terry came down. One was we had in our sights a final description. Nothing is final, but we had a satisfactory description, what people in physics might call a standard model. We were within range of a standard model of how memories are encoded. That is the actual chemical event.
So it's a chemical.
There's a chemical structural change that happens between the connections between the neurons and the cortex. They connect each other. They have anywhere from 20 to 40,000 connections between every cell in your cortex and a bunch of other cells. So you'll have 100 billion of these things making 20, 30,000 connections. The most complex object ever encountered by the race. And at each one of those little connections between the brain cells, there is a chemical process. And that chemical process allows the brain, when you're sending signals of the right kind, it lets that connection change. There's a chemical process that gets kicked off, and it physically changes the connection. So the connection is now more potent. It's as though these two neurons can talk to each other more directly. And what we were searching for was the nature of, we were quite convinced that there was a structural change. We were looking for the chemistry that did it. And then that's what I told Terry we were on the verge of. And that's the piece that's been finished, pretty much finished. We do know. And that's got enormous ramifications of that. Now that we know what it is, we think we know why it goes wrong in things like autism. We think we know how to make it work better. Because for those of you that follow politics... you can see why there's a good reason to make it work better. Or you might say, even make it work good. I don't think we were lacking reasons or examples. So we thought those things would happen. And I think that story is unfolding now. I think we're now saying this is the mechanism, and we are showing that mechanism is disturbed in a broad variety of psychiatric illnesses, and we have come up with treatments or drugs to enhance it. That was the piece we were after. That was the piece we should have had done in that first couple months. That's the piece that took 4 or 5 years. And I'm going to go on for just a second. The other part of that was the belief that once we knew the chemical process, we would be able to take out part of it and use it as a marker and have an animal learn an everyday human-like situation and then be able to go in the brain and map all the changes that had happened in the brain. In other words, get a memory map. And that's the piece that Terry mentioned happened after he left, because he caught on to the fact that that's what we were finally after. We were after a memory map. And why a memory map? Because once you know where memory is, you can ask this question: how is it ever reassembled? And when Larry said, when you leave here, and hopefully you remember my part, Terry's part, but my part,
when you leave, the ultimate mystery is those, we know that the pieces of the memory are scattered all over your cortex in tiny little fragments. How do you reassemble those? Once we know where the pieces are, I'm confident that theorists like Larry, working with people like me, will be able to come up with a first theory of how you reassemble them, and that will be a first theory of thought.
And I think this is, you know, a great explanation of a biological explanation, the way neuroscientists think about it. Now we ask the non-biologist reporter who spent 4 years thinking about this, you know, how would you explain the situation in terms of memory? Is what Gary is saying, is that...
No, not from
a totally technical point of view, but I mean, just, you know, if you had to sit down and explain to your wife, what did I learn about how does it work? You know,
right. I don't think his wife would ask.
Well, you know, sorry, Millie. The one thing is, I'm astonished every day at the complexity of the machinery, and appalled by it. It is, you often see the brain described as this elegant construction. It's the least elegant thing I've ever seen. I mean, it is just a mess. And the reason it's a mess, it's what Henry Ford was supposed to have said about history, is it's just one damn thing after another. And the brain is a product of a historical process, evolution. And so you get this all this crap piled on top of itself. You get, like, you got at the bottom, you got this little frog brain, and then you got, you know, a little squirrel brain on top of that, and then you get, you know, the neocortex on top of that, and then it's all just, it's not designed, it just happens, and then it wires together by itself. It's a mess. I mean, at the end of it, I sit there and think, you know, I'm never amazed when it doesn't work. I'm astonished when it does.
That's a fair... Now, this is... not exactly getting away from this, but it's science writing for the public, basically. I mean, you know, it's hard, really hard for us as being immersed in this to explain it to the public, like an audience like this. And, you know, how, so Terry, you know, in terms, there's a big gap there, I think, in explaining science to the general public in a way that's interesting and accurate and so on and so forth. So did you, you know, actually, this is maybe the first science writing you've really done? Or what have you learned? Is there any different than anything else, really?
Well, it's more technical.
Okay.
But if you're an outsider in any field, you're...
The law,
you're,
whatever.
You're new to it. Yeah. So the first thing you have to do is learn how to get stuff right. Things that happens with science writing, though, is that editors, the first thing they do if you hand in a long piece that's on science is they take all the science out of it. And the second thing they do is they take all the characters out of it. So you'll have what's left is something pretty drab and boring. And they will actually say it's too science-y. Well, you know, that's kind of the point. And you'll read a lot of science stories that will begin with this really provocative idea. And then there'll be like a little anecdote that sort of explores it a little bit. And then there'll be a paragraph that says, this stuff is really too complicated to explain here in the newspaper, so we'll just won't do that. And then you'll go back and have people talking about the thing they never explained. So I swore to myself when I did this that there would be a lot of science in the book. And there is. It's for many readers, I think it might be, parts of it will be pretty tough going. But I think that the fact that you have a character like this madman here, he'll carry the story through, and you'll stick to find out what happens to him and the kids in the lab. And that's the hope, is that the story will carry them through the science.
It's interesting, because Gary has also written a very interesting book that, well, borders on popular. It is popular, actually, yeah. And it's for sale out there, by the way. You'll want to get a copy of both books. But, you know, you're embedded in the science, and when you wrote this book, it probably didn't have some of the elements that Terry's talking about, for example, character. It's really a science.
It's a very different
thing. Well, tell actually, what is the basic topic? Big brains, actually.
Yes. Well,
it's interesting.
It's a question of the relationship between brain size and intelligence. And it makes the point that we enjoy the happy thought that we are somehow the pinnacle of creation because we are the most intelligent animal we've met thus far, which may not be saying a whole hell of a lot. And it makes the point that actually human brains were larger in the past, and then it goes off, as it happens, they were. And then it goes off, and in fact, it talks about one group of people who had brains that were very, very large, maybe a quarter larger than ours. And then it says, well, wow, they had huge brains, and it goes into the relationship between brain size and why is brain size related to intelligence, to intelligent behavior. And that's basically what the book goes into. So it gets technical at some times, and then it drifts in and out. I wouldn't say it's anywhere near the same sort of thing as
Terry's. But it's a fascinating topic, and stop
even
and think.
Even if you screwed it up.
Well, I think the editor screwed it up. And that, you just blamed everything on your failed efforts.
Works
it was always
me.
The editor's. Yeah, I'll go with that. I think the editor screwed it up. But it's got some fascinating art in it, and some people have found it really, really interesting. It talks about stuff, sorts of things that you just don't come across ordinarily, like, or were there really human beings 30,000 years ago that had brains substantially larger than yours? What would that mean? We do some extrapolations in there between brain size and IQ and say how much IQ they would have. A lot of it, some of it's fun. But going back to the thing of how memory works and where it's located and all that, it's important to understand that there is a community aspect to this whole thing. When it's done and said, and I think you quote Alcino Silva over there at UCLA as making the point that it's been an astonishing success story for the field of neuroscience, and people just really haven't heard about it, and maybe through Terry's book more people will hear about it, but it's been an enormous success. One of the most profound questions faced by the life sciences has been, I think, pretty much taken care of.
But now you have to, at some point, bridge this basic science with some of the clinical problems like Alzheimer's.
Right.
And how are you actually going to, you know, this has been painfully slow so far in terms of some actual cures or prevention of Alzheimer's. So how is that gap going to narrow?
Well, I'm convinced that the problem, why we've had so little success in treating neuropsychiatric disorders in general, Alzheimer's in particular, is because the field has been forced into looking at these problems one protein at a time. Unfortunately, these little synapses that we're talking about have probably got 20 or 30,000 different kinds of proteins in them. And if we're going to go one protein at a time, hoping that we find that this protein is responsible for Alzheimer's, this protein is responsible for autism, that simply isn't going to work. And that's one reason why progress has been so slow. Now, what I'm saying is,
in other words, the strategy may not be.
It's the strategy's bad, and that strategy goes all the way back to Washington. It's the academic scientists, including me and you, who have launched that strategy. And let's face it, it's just a really crappy strategy. But try and change it. So I think, no, now that what we have is a system, we see a system of synapses and a system of chemical pathways inside synapses, and now having this overview, we can stand back from that and say, are there any commonalities between rodent models of autism, attention deficit disorder, mental retardation? Are there commonalities? And a big part of the research going on down there in our labs now, and if anybody out there, by the way, has a couple million and really wants to accelerate it, we'll be out there signing books, and anybody wants to sign checks, you can join us. But I think we are now making serious progress towards saying, yes, it's a system failure for these diseases. And now that we see the system, I think we're getting a better picture of where it fails.
You know, Terry, you were spending 4 or 5 years on this. You had to give some serious thought about, you know, the clinical approaches to Alzheimer's and so on. I mean, what's your take on the log jam or the slow progress?
I think it's purely sociology. I actually went after I did this report. I went and did a separate story on Alzheimer's, and what I found is that they've been studying the same two main hypotheses for one of them for 40 years, another one for 20 years, and one predicts that there's this thing called amyloid plaque that interferes with communication between neurons. The other is these tau tangles form inside neurons. In both cases, the neurons die. They've been at this long enough now that they have longitudinal studies where they start with people, ordinary people without dementia in middle age, 40, 50 years old, and then they test them every year. And at the end, I mean, some of them develop dementia, some of them don't. And at the end, they collect their brains and autopsy them. And now they've had like 800 or 900 brains autopsied. And people who've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's don't have the amyloid plaque or the tau tangles. People who haven't been do. You know, the hypothesis is wrong.
It's just wrong.
Yeah, it's just completely wrong. But the system is set up so that in order to get a grant, if you want to propose some other strategy, some other cause of Alzheimer's, well, who's going to review that grant? It's the people who've invested their whole career in tau or amyloid, and you're not going to get it, and you're not going to get, then you don't get published. Pretty soon you're out on the street with me,
and that's not a good place.
So, yep. Here's the
absolutely. I mean, it's cold out here.
Right. Here's the question on everybody's mind, Gary. And Terry, 101 Theory Drive.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Where did the title of this book actually come from? We'll get two different versions.
Yeah,
of this,
sure. I want that. I've been banished to a kind of research archipelago by the University of California. I think they thought the whole world would be safer if I was a quarter mile off campus. So I'm out there in a research park, and it's a road, and of course it's the Irvine Company down there. So of course they name these roads, these preposterous names of these roads, like Theory Drive. I mean, this is biotechnology. The best this should be called would be Hunch Road. maybe at the very end, Working Hypothesis Lane. Theory Drive.
You got to admit, it made a great title for the book. Yeah. What was the inspiration on that?
Yeah. It wasn't an inspiration. I was ordered by my editor.
Oh. There you go. See, there you are again, as editors.
No, my title was The Magnificent Contraption, which is how I saw the brain, and which I still like better, but which is probably a horrible title. But it's interesting, in biology, there's only one theory of biology. It's evolution. But biologists never talk about theory, ever. You never hear it. In fact, if they talk about it, they get their mouth washed out.
It's completely different than physics.
Completely. Example. Yeah, everybody's got a theory.
Yeah.
So there's none. And in fact, when you go to these meetings, which I went to, many, many of these scientific conventions, talks, or I don't know how many.
Boondoggles, as you call them.
Well, actually, I was surprised at the number of scientists who actually went to the sessions. In neuroscience, the big guys would all come. The big guns in neuroscience would be sitting right there. Imagine you're a postdoc giving your first one of these things. Yeah. And you're looking down there, here's Lynch, and here's Tim Bliss, and Candel. I mean, this is ridiculous. They're just, and not only that, when the guy's done, they go, oh, that was very interesting talk, very interesting ideas. And then they just drill them. just limb from limb. But what they when they give these talks, they never mention theory. The word isn't ever used. And they don't even use the word hypothesis. They say story.
Yeah,
exactly. My story.
Right.
And somebody will say about somebody else, well, he has a good story. And I actually think that that's a deeper reflection of the lack of confidence that the field is ever going to solve anything. I really do. I mean,
let's tell
a story.
And when you asked the question at the very beginning, Larry, about why do you have people come in?
Yeah.
Why do you let them in? It's for that kind of insight. That is the problem. I mean, when people say, why is the process of curing disease, neuropsychiatric diseases, why does that go so slowly? Why is drug development so slow? That is the problem. What he's talking about right there is dead on. It's a field which is terrified of overarching hypotheses. By the way, it wasn't always this way. I mean, there were people that wrote major hypotheses, but the current version of the field is it's just a bunch of people who are really frightened of big ideas. And yet, come on, it's science. It's always science. It goes back to Galileo, who came and said, you're supposed to have this hypothesis before you start. Newton said, that's really great. Let's make that, put that in concrete, or whatever they had then. Let's put it in stone and make it that way. You're supposed to have this hypothesis, and it's supposed to be a big hypothesis and a big question, and then you're testing it. And in our own timid time, it appears in your field, of which you are a major senior ruler,
an archon. That standard model, which has served science so well for so long, seems to be petered out.
Yeah, you mentioned Silva. Just what he actually said, he misquoted him, was that, you know, what people don't understand is that in the 90s and the first half of the 2000s, that they've established, neuroscience has established what memory is. And it's this process that Gary referred to called LTP. And Silva says, you know, led by Lynch, you know, we now know what it is. And he says, and nobody knows, we know it. And he says, think about that. This is an achievement of historic proportion. He says, this is Newtonian. This is Einstein great. And nobody knows it happened.
Well, there's so much skepticism in the field, and there's why is that actually?
I think it's just from reading the history of neuroscience, which only came into existence really in the late 60s, early 70s,
in its current form,
and everybody rushed in, and they were going to solve this problem of the brain. You know, I don't know. It's like Gary, next week, next month, but soon we had a decade of the brain declared, and I think everybody realized at some point the complexity of the target, the difficulty of it. And if you've got 100 billion neurons, every neuron has 40,000 proteins in it that can form a quadrillion or more connections. I mean, Jesus, you just, where do you go from there? And I think people just kind of went, not me. No.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, but it's also the case that science, as we all know from our good friends in literature and sociology, science, as all social institutions do, reflects the time in which it's being done. And these are not times that encourage this sort of big thinking. I mean, everywhere we look, we see things jammed up. We see people looking for micro solutions. In a way, I think all of that is infiltrated into science, and it's into our science at least, and it's led to this kind, as I say, this kind of timidity about getting in there and taking big shots.
Well, I think you can see from this discussion that, you know, how actually exciting the questions of neuroscience are. And it really is a magnet for a lot of these young, bright students who are coming in. It's a very dynamic field. And I think this is a perfect time, actually. Why don't we take a break here and go out to the audience for questions? Leave plenty of time, because I'm sure there's a lot of interesting stuff. Oh, and by the way, yeah, we have microphones here, so we will call on people that have the microphone. Okay, I think this woman right here in the dark, yeah.
Clearly I'm not a scientist. This is a non-scientist question. But I was really interested by what you were saying about the sort of native disorganization of the brain and how we have sort of older versions, OS1, OS2, OS3 sitting on top of each other. And so I was just really curious, again, not a scientist question, but I was really curious, once you isolate this in mice, is there a secondary process to sort of make the equation in humans? Or the fact that we're all mammals just means that quite necessarily that equation is a self-evident one. It might be a really ignorant question, but I'm curious about the answer.
No, that's a very good question. And that is one of the issues that, oddly enough, that my book deals with this a bit. The argument, unfortunately, as it turns out, this is a mammalian brain. Okay, it's different from other mammalian brains to the extent that it's a primate brain. Okay, but once it's in a primate brain format, it has all those basic mammalian characteristics that Terry was referring to, and then it has those specialties to go with the primates, and then really the only major difference is that it's very, very large. Okay, so if human beings, the distinguishing biological feature of human beings quantitatively is the fact that the brain is gargantuan compared to other primates, say, compared to chimpanzees. Human brain is gargantuan, it's huge. But that's it. I mean, there may be subtle differences here and there, but the overwhelming difference is it's just big. All that other stuff, the frog brain, Terry's, why he picked a squirrel, no accounting for this, but there's some artistic thing about writing, I'm sure. Anyway, I wouldn't have picked a squirrel, but I'm trying to say. But all that's just there, and the reason you don't know about it so clearly is this vast, giant cortex is controlling it to a very high degree, but it's all still there.
And it's very interesting. I mean, when you get into what neuroscience has taught us, you know, there were things like Copernicus saying, you know what, we're not the center of the universe. Darwin saying, you know, maybe we weren't specially created necessarily. And in terms of the brain, Gary was very, you know, cautious to say primates, but whales have about a brain that has a volume about eight size the times of ours, and elephants have a huge brain compared to ours. And, you know, in a way, we're another specialized mammal, really. This is sort of a perspective on things, but this is another sort of biological perspective. And so what Gary is saying, I think I really agree with it. There's some basic mechanism that's probably common to all mammals.
Oh, yeah. It's all there. There's a piece in my book about, I always love the scene, I don't know if you've ever seen it, there's a movie called Forbidden Planet, and this is actually in my book, I love the scene, and in the scene, I won't go through the whole movie, but the business is this, okay?
Thanks.
You have all that? The business is that there was a race of people in this faraway planet, and they had built this extraordinary civilization, and then they vanished in one night, and the Earth people come, and they're trying to solve this. And the Earthlings solve it. And the guide says this, of course, as he's dying, he says, I've got the answer. It's monsters, monsters from the id. And they ask, what does that mean? And he says, well, it's a 20th century concept, but it means that no matter how large the cortex grows, even in this almost godlike race of creatures on this other planet, no matter how large the cortex grew, the beast was always beneath.
It's a great story.
It's a joy killer
right
there.
Right in the back row here. Right here.
Is it possible that memory can reside in parts other than the brain, muscle memory in the muscles, mm-hmm. or perhaps emotional memory that's captured mm-hmm. somatically? Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question. The muscle memory is actually memory of a set of movements, most of which are probably programmed higher up in the brain. So the short answer to your question is we know of no other place where we could find a memory-like mechanism other than the brain. Memory is very, very strange stuff. It forms quickly, it lasts for extremely long periods of time, and it's there in vast, vast quantities. And biologists have just never found anything that could satisfy those criteria other than these synapses in the cortex.
You know, and it's hard. You have to be careful about how you define memory because, you know, you see ads for carpet with memory. You know, I mean, we're talking about something
point.
Different here, actually.
Yeah. But emotional memory, it's going to have to be.
The gentleman back here. Blue shirt.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for an incredibly interesting evening. It's just fantastic. I had spent 3.5 years doing research in a cancer lab, and this is just totally off this topic. But going back to the previous statement about planets and stuff, I was just curious what you thought of Stephen Hawking's recent remark about let's not look for the aliens.
Yeah, that's you. No, I think it's a really interesting question. I saw the statement. I'm just saying it's him because the word alien.
the statement's alien to me. I don't know what it is.
Oh, so. You don't know about it? I don't really see that argument.
But, I mean, now restate the argument a little bit here.
Hawking, who you know is one of the great black hole physicists ever, and legendary for Hawking radiation and the rest of it. Basically came out recently and said, you know, look, it's pretty obvious there's life, intelligent life out there, and here's some arguments for why we shouldn't bother to try and get in touch with it, which, let's face it, we're trying to do, whether we mean to or not. Uh-huh. And he came out with some arguments for why we wouldn't want to do that. I don't agree with that because in the end of the day, I have a terrible suspicion that all intelligence will be very similar. The different intelligences will be very, very similar. But I would imagine they would be able to communicate better than what he's thinking about. because in the end, everything we've learned about the cortex says this kind of network property that it has, surprisingly enough, moves into a computational world that would be recognizable to almost anyone that did computation. So if they're out there and they got spaceships, I'm guessing they got computers. They got computers, we'll speak.
Interesting. Let's see, back here in the back row over here, wait for the mic.
In the early 2000s, there were a bunch of neuroscientists who were writing books saying that that consciousness has been explained and that, you know, it's an emergent property and that they know it and understand it. And I'm a dualist. I don't believe that you guys know anything. I think there's something.
You're not
going
to get any argument there.
So I'd love to hear what you guys think and what neuroscientists in general think. Like, is there an argument going on?
Nobody thinks it's solved.
No. I mean,
and Dennett's book has been more often.
Dennett.
Yeah. The book's called Consciousness Explained. Many people referred to it as Consciousness Explained Away. which I mean, he's a philosopher, and he's brilliant at argument making, and there are brilliant arguments in there, but I don't think that actually gets anywhere in the end. I mean, my favorite description of consciousness is Jerry Edelman's, who's a biologist in San Diego.
Nobel.
Yeah, and he calls consciousness the remembered present, which is really, aside from being poetic, I mean, it's loaded with meaning. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, and if memory is an emergent quality, then that would make consciousness the same.
Yeah, no, I mean, I
the dualist shakes his head.
I think that's a question. There are many questions in science that we're not at the point where we can address those questions. And so I see those books as being very premature. It also doesn't help me at all that my philosopher friends just rip them to shreds and use them for whatever I don't want to mention. But I do think it's the case that our science is not advanced to the point where it's ready to take on a notion such as how do you retrieve a memory? Let alone how do you retrieve that memory and stick six memories together and call that a thought or a sentence. If we can't answer that, then I don't think we're nearly at the time or place to try and take on something like consciousness. But it'll be fun, hopefully, 20 years from now.
Yeah, so I think a biologist, Claude Bernard, was the one that came up with, you know, the argument in the 19th century for, you know, against dualism in biology, saying that you know, you can explain the heart, you can explain how the kidney works, you can explain all the organs pretty much in the body. You come to the brain, and it's extremely complicated, but it's an organ. And in principle, why couldn't you explain the cortex of the brain the same way you could explain the cortex of the kidney? It's just much more complicated. But as a scientist, you sort of have the idea in mind that it's at least possible to do.
Yeah, it's at least possible, but it always has to be underlined that when you deal with the cortex, you are dealing with a thing of monstrous complexity.
Exactly.
In fact, a thing of such complexity that we don't, as a human race, have experience with that kind of thing. So when you have that kind of complexity, the properties that could bubble up out of it are...
What's interesting is, you know, a lot of this has changed in the last 10 years with the emergence of the internet, because this is an exceptionally complicated network that humans actually sort of built. I don't know if they designed it, but it emerged. And so to actually understand a network of that complexity, all of a sudden the engineers and mathematicians are saying, you know, what you're telling me about the brain is not all that complicated. I mean, we could probably deal with it. But it's giving sort of a hope that... you know, maybe it's not as intractable as the past.
I was certainly more around.
Let's see. Right down here in front.
Thank you. Do you have any comments about theory of autism and whether it's related to the tangle of nerves, too many nerves, and, you know, relate to that?
Right. Well, in the first place, there isn't going to be a single explanation for it. And no matter how many times we go down this road, we keep making the same mistake, okay? Nixon launched the war on cancer that quickly became America's medical Vietnam. But did we learn? Yeah. That didn't do any good. And why? Because there's probably 400 genes now that are predisposing toward cancer. Maybe it's 100, but it's in that ballpark, okay? Autism is the same kind of thing. It's going to turn out to be a condition that is a kind of default condition that you can get to from any one of several different routes. It's going to turn out to be the way it is with Alzheimer's. You're going to be able to, Alzheimer's is a default when stuff goes wrong. And as Terry said, and he's quite right, it's a wonder the thing ever works. But having said that, I think that we're getting to a point now where the animal models are getting better and better. And I do believe that we have the sophistication now to ask the question, why or how are the synapses in these models, how are they messed up? And I think we're closing quickly on that question.
Things are moving fast.
They're moving fast. And it will probably turn out to be a synaptic problem.
Down here in front row, this lady. Just one sec. Here comes the mic.
Thank you. For the developments and solutions that took place in your lab or elsewhere since Terry's book was written, where would you recommend a layman with a reasonably conversant medical vocabulary look for what is the current state of the art and updates?
The stuff that we are now at, our first memory maps, that material is not published, and so can't send you any of that. Because these journals have a nasty habit of saying that, you know, it has to be only in their place. However, much of the other stuff, if you just send an email to me, I'll get one of these people that are there, and they'll send you a mountain of stuff.
But, you know, you raise an interesting thing. There should be some blogs out there that sort of keep people up to date on sort of a field, you know, in a way where you could go and find, you know, the Huffington Post of neuroscience. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, we could send, yeah, absolutely. Huffington Post of neuroscience would be a great idea. But we can send you some preprints of papers that are coming along. We're publishing papers now on areas like, a lot's dealing with the major form of mental retardation, animal models on that. A lot of it's, we'll send you a bunch of stuff.
down here in the white coat, Dr. Bowdry.
Oh, there's a ringer in the audience, Terry. There's a ringer. That's a ringer. That's no audience member.
I'll take this one.
So there are several major projects now going on to try to either build a brain or simulate a brain. And so what are your thoughts about these large enterprises?
What did I say?
You said this one's yours, I think.
Yeah. I should say, Michel Bowdry was co-author with Gary on this paper that first laid out this explanation that has now been fulfilled in 1984. And part of the problem Gary had all these years in getting any closure on it was the inability to admit that they were right. Seriously, I mean, there was an awful lot of guesswork involved, or educated, presumably. But anyhow, it's one of the is a huge.
Well, they weren't at Columbia either. You know.
Yeah. You know, I think Gary was involved with one of the early attempts at the brain on the chip thing, right? And all I got out of it was a double wide trailer. So, I'm skeptical of that kind of stuff. But you know, it's just hardware. I mean, if you can make it complex enough, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't eventually work.
Yeah, it's just making it complex enough.
Yeah.
I mean, well, and the architecture is important too, isn't it? The design, I think.
It's the worst part of it is that and Terry's book does a great job of this. A lot of the design doesn't make any particular sense. I did found the company with the idea of the human interface, and we were going to take brain designs and make them into computer chips. And I got Michelle tangled up in that. It's a great story because we all went up trundling on up to Silicon Valley, and they said, this is the greatest idea in the world. This is really what we need to do. You know, this damn computer thing is here, and you're here. We need something in between. How about a computer that's based on a brain? So we went up there and we explained the brain to them, and the engineers looked at that and they said, nobody in his right mind is ever going to build anything like that. It can't be like that. It, I mean, it's too stupid. It's why are these pieces in here? Of course, Michelle and I are there going, we have no idea. No one has any idea why that part's in there. And then, and it was, so it all ended out. And they went, of course, they went on and became a huge success, with, but they never did build a silicon brain. I think that that effort at this point is another one of these way too early. Because how complicated do you make a synapse?
Okay. One synapse.
One synapse. How complicated is one synapse, okay? I mean, we already know the thing does dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of operations that we know about, and how many more are there? So the idea you're going to go out and build one of these things, happy days.
So I think, unfortunately...
But give me a call if anybody wants to try.
We probably only have time for maybe two more questions. Louise, do you have a question? I think you get...
No, I don't know if you can comment on this, Terry. You talked about character and carrying the story, but I was so impressed and with your use of metaphor, you know, coming up with metaphors to talk about the brain. Is there anything you can comment on about that? I mean, is there a strategy? Is it just, you know, divine inspiration? I mean, the one I read about, you know, the shelves and the... I mean, those are real ways to, you know, you're translating from one medium to another. You're a translator. And that's a really mysterious process in and of itself. And I wondered if you could say something about that.
Well, I try to keep the technical language to a minimum. I mean, there's a lot of it, but didn't want it to be overwhelming. And I also found that just for myself, my own trying to understand this stuff, a lot of the ideas would be the kind of thing like you'd get it, and then it would be gone. You know, I couldn't quite hold on to it, and so I had to find ways to think about them. But on the sort of more basic level, I mean, that's called writing. I mean, that's one of my jobs is to make stuff understandable. And it's any writer has the same job. I mean, a poet has the same job, and they do it in a much more contained way. But still, it's the power of the image that you can create that makes the thing last in somebody's brain.
We have a question way up here in the back, I think. Yeah.
I have a nephew. He's about 1.5 years old. And every time I see him, I try to alter what I'm doing. And usually he laughs at the very end. So I'm guessing he's, you know, remembering what I just did. So wouldn't like memory be just remembering sequences of sequences and pretty much, you know, to like 4 years, you just have all these sequences remembered. And then at 4 years, you can do inference and, you know, pretty much decide which route you want to take. That's pretty much how it works, right?
Right.
And then different stages after that, right? So I don't know what I'm trying to get at, but any thoughts to this?
So why'd you waste all that time studying this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing to watch your 1.5-year-old nephew do that, because it does appear they're going through, he's going through the same nephews of the boys, right?
Yes.
See, I do use this guy. Watching that child do that, by the way, it's a great idea you're doing that, because the idea of driving the learning machine is just a really good idea, and we have understanding of why that is, why it's good for the brain. But one of the things that's fascinating about your nephew is that he's not going to remember that. You see? He's not going to remember any of this, which is really curious, because when he's 6 and you're doing it, he has a pretty good chance of remembering quite a lot of it, but not when he's 1.5. And it's called infantile amnesia. And there really are any number of hypotheses about why that is, or if that material is actually still in there someplace and could be retrieved. It's actually a fascinating case.
What do they say, Gary, that you can remember back to maybe 2 or 3?
Three is realistically.
Yeah.
People earlier than that are generally, you know, generating memories. But it is fascinating because there's this kid who seems to be doing the memory stuff and the sequences and the following and all the rest of it, and yet somehow it all slips away, and that's another one of these little mysteries. I don't know if that was any use to you or not. But.
Okay, we got time for two more. There's a lady back here in the, is it green? Yeah.
Oh, they'd already given up the mics.
Ah, yeah, I tricked them. I said, Louise tells me we've got time for two more here. Maybe you can just stand up and project.
Yell it out.
No, he's got
oh, here we go. Here we go.
I want to follow up on Louise's question about the importance of context in communicating to lay people what some really significant stuff is going on. And so, especially in the nature of media today, it seems like we're really losing that ability more and more. And where do you see the hope for getting this kind of information, knowledge, and some kind of contextual versus bits and pieces out in with some kind of integrity rather than, you know, I believe this no matter what's going on.
I think that's a Terry question.
Yeah, I don't have a happy answer. I think that the kind of stuff that I would do at a newspaper will increasingly not be done at all. I was talking about a project I did once with a bunch of business executives, and they were following along. They were really, you could tell when you had them, they were really rapt, they were really interested in it. And one of them stopped me and said, "Yeah, excuse me, I just have to ask, how does this cost out?" And think about it. You know, I'm 4 years in a lab for one story or a few stories. It doesn't cost out. We were in a kind of golden age of journalism and didn't know it. And it's diminishing by the day. And you really can't blame people, I mean, to a certain extent. If the money's not there, this is a luxury. In fact, that's what they told told me when they fired me, that I was a luxury they could no longer afford. And the simple fact is that writing books, if it takes you 4 years to write a book and you don't have another job, you know, somebody's not going to be eating very well. It's a tough thing. I don't know. But because to a significant extent, newspapers subsidize this kind of stuff in that period of 20 years. Magazines don't do that. So, well, maybe one or two do, but not actually even to that depth. If you called up the editor of The New Yorker and said you wanted to spend 3 years on a story, he'd wish you good luck and goodbye. So I don't have great hopes for it. I mean, there's more information available, but less context, less cohesion. And one of my complaints is that, you know, opinions are cheap, actually. I mean, there's no scarcity to them. And facts are hard. And facts are hard to find. And they're hard to assemble enough of them into some sort of coherence. And that's the great difficulty, I think. What I fear we'll lose is the ability to get facts. So we'll get, in the end, we'll get even dumber than we are today.
Okay, one more, and then we'll go out and have a book signing outside here. Okay, this gentleman in the yellow shirt.
You've been using the word memory. I'm a teacher, and I was thinking about it in relationship to learning, particularly when you talked about this gentleman's nephew, and you said, well, he's not going to remember any of that. And I thought, well, he's not going to remember what happened, but something is being built, some kind of memory, right? I mean, that's what we call learning. So I'm interested if there's a distinction there or how you think about the structure of that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And that's what I meant by saying it's always a very good idea to be doing all that interacting because it's good for the brain. Yeah, we use in neuroscience, we use the terms to mean this. Learning is the act whereby you are encoding memory. And so we separate those two. We enhance learning is what we're trying to do with the idea that later the memory will be stronger. But your other point about the learning that is not remembered, nonetheless, in some senses, is in there influencing the overall operation of the networks is a very, very good point, very subtle point. And honestly, I don't think there's much that we know about that. So yeah, your nephew may have some effect of that, although it won't be retrievable as a memory. And it's a very good point.
Terrific. So, Aloud and Louise, thank you very much for having us tonight.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.